dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KFAR Knoxville, and KRFP Moscow, Idaho 92.5. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we'll focus on how the corporate media system is undermining the conditions necessary for democratic governance. And we'll hear frank talk from two public officials who have joined forces with scholars, journalists, and citizens in the media democracy movement to do something about it. We'll begin with a forum on media consolidation that took place last week at Ithaca College. Among the participants were dissident FCC Commissioner Michael Copps and Ithaca's Member of Congress Maurice Hinchey, who has introduced a bill that, if passed, would take steps to diversify media ownership and reinstitute the fairness doctrine. We'll conclude the program with an interview with John Buchanan, author of Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold on Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us this afternoon to hear a discussion of what is certainly one of the most important issues confronting a democracy in a digital age. Today, concentration of the media in the hands of a select number of very large, very powerful conglomerates presents real threats to the free marketplace of ideas upon which a thriving democracy depends. In a summary of the current state of American media, The Nation magazine described it this way: the domination of the media by entertainment conglomerates exerts a consistently corrosive effect on journalism, undermining debate in this country precisely when we need it most. Given the importance and relevance of this issue, it is my distinct pleasure this afternoon to introduce you to three experts in the field of media ownership and concentration. The first, Michael J. Copps, is one of five commissioners directing the Federal Communications Commission, an organization established in 1934 to regulate the media. During his tenure at the FCC, Mr. Copps has been the most outspoken opponent and tireless adversary of FCC Chairman Michael Powell's efforts to loosen rules that would permit the ever-increasing concentration of American media. Clearly a man of strong opinions and integrity, Michael Copps has a well-earned reputation as a defender of democratic ideals and the public good. Second, let me introduce Maurice Hinchey, a congressman who has represented the people of New York State for nearly 30 years, 18 as a member of the New York State Assembly, and 12 as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Hinchey has served on the House Committee on Banking and Financial Services and the House Committee on Natural Resources, as well as the House Appropriations Committee. He has been an active opponent of the continuing erosion of media ownership rules, and he is the author of the Media Ownership Reform Act of 2004. Wenmuth Williams is a professor and chair of the Ithaca College Department of Television and Radio. A faculty member at the college since 1984, Dr. Williams has served as a consultant to a number of organizations, including National Public Radio and the Longman Publishing Group. He has taught courses on communications law and regulation, government and media, and ethical issues in mass communications. Today's panel discussion will be moderated by Dr. Barbara Morgenstern, an associate professor in the Department of Television and Radio. Thank you very much, and I'm sure we're going to have a really fascinating discussion.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming here today. I think it's a wonderful opportunity that we have to be able to discuss such a very important issue that affects really each of our lives in a number of different ways. Again, welcome everyone. Thank everyone. And if we could begin with Commissioner Copps.
I am delighted to be here. I'm really thrilled that you all asked me to participate in this important discussion this afternoon. I want to thank especially the college and the Roy H. Park School of Communications for organizing this discussion and for bringing us all together today. And let me also thank my friend Congressman Hinchey for inviting me to join him here in his district, and thank him more specifically for his vision and leadership on the issues that we are going to be discussing today. He is a great public servant who has been a champion on so many issues, including media ownership and diversity in our media, and has brought really a much better dialogue to our discussion of things having to do with the media. So I'm thrilled to be here in his district with him and to be here with all of you. This is really, the way I see it, the continuation of a truly remarkable grassroots dialogue that has taken a place across this country of ours over the period of the last year and a half. Over that period of time, we have really seen a true outpouring, a cascading national concern over what many Americans, Congressman Hinchey and myself included, see as truly disturbing trends in our media. And my message to you this afternoon is that media consolidation, which simply means a few companies, huge companies owning and controlling more and more of our broadcast outlets, is not just a threat, it's already a reality. Fewer big companies already own more properties. Media conglomerates own radio, they own television, and they own cable systems and cable channels. In many cities, they own the already monopolistic newspaper, too. They own the production of programming, they own the distribution of programming, and increasingly, they own the very act of creativity itself, which I think is really something for us all to think about. Many Americans have stood up and said, enough. These folks already own too much. And it runs the gamut. Concerned parents, creative artists, religious leaders, civil rights activists, labor organizations, young people, old people, even a lot of small and independent broadcasters, and many others from all over the country coming together to express their concern and to express their alarm over the direction that we seem to be heading. And these citizens are asking how many, or maybe better, how few companies should be allowed to control America's TV and radio and newspapers and, increasingly, even the Internet. Will we still be able to get real local news and clashing points of view so that Americans can make up their own minds on the issues of the day? And how do we assure quality TV and music instead of so often being fed this diet of pre-canned and nationalized fare that's aimed primarily at selling products? And I don't think I exaggerate at all in saying that what's really at issue here is whether a few big media conglomerates are going to be given content control over our music and our entertainment and our news and information, gatekeeper control over the civil dialogue of the country we live in, and veto power over the majority of what we see and hear and read. Tremendous concern. The people's representatives in Congress answered these citizens' concern. The U.S. Senate has voted twice now to overturn in its entirety the decision that the majority took in June of 2003 to loosen the media ownership rules that we had. And over 200 members of the House of Representatives, led by Representative Hinchey, have asked the House leadership for permission to vote on this very same resolution of disapproval. And so far, they have been denied that vote. But I think if they had the opportunity to vote this week or when they come back next month, they would overwhelmingly disapprove of those Senate rules, too. So the Congress responded. The court has now responded. Last June, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia ruled that the majority's plan, which was passed to weaken the ownership limits, was legally and procedurally flawed. So we've heard from the courts, we've heard from the Congress, we've heard the American people that the FCC got it wrong when we tried to unleash even more media consolidation. Who else do we need to hear from? It should be clear by now, even to my colleagues on the commission, who got it so wrong that they need to reassess their approach, they need to do this again, and this time they need to do it right. But let me point out that it's no slam dunk that that's going to happen. It's very good news that the court sent those rules back. But where did they send them back to? To the very same folks who dreamed them up in the first place. So an entirely plausible outcome of this whole exercise could still be rules every bit as bad or worse than the ones the majority tried to foist on us in June of 2003. And throw in the fact that big media will be right there lobbying for everything they're worth, and they're worth a lot, and you get an idea of the battle that lies ahead for the American people. And I think too many Americans think, well, gee, didn't the Senate overturn this, or didn't the court send it back? We must have won. Whoopee. But that's not true at all. We're right back at square one. We have momentarily stayed these new rules and stopped them from going into effect. But as I say, it could still go down entirely the wrong road. Any discussion about the future of the media should begin with one single premise. And that premise is that the people, all of us, you and me, own the airwaves. No company in this great country of ours owns an airwave, owns one single airwave. Corporations are given the privilege of using this precious public asset and to profit rather handsomely from that use, by the way, in exchange for their commitment to serve the public interest. That's the deal. That's the quid pro quo. That's what Congress had in mind when it passed the Telecommunications Act. And that term public interest appears, incidentally, 112 times in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. I used to work in Congress. When somebody told me, one of the members of Congress told me something once, I stood up and paid attention. When they tell me 112 times, I stand up and salute, and I spend an inordinate amount of time right now trying to get my colleagues at the commission to stand up and salute this concept of the public interest, which appears 112 times in the law. So broadcasting is a special industry. It serves the public interest. That's supposed to be its North Star, its lodestar, each day, every day. Yet study upon study presents a really bleak picture of what is happening. Just look at the political coverage that we are hearing, or should I say we are supposed to be hearing, this year. This is an election year. Issues of peace and war, people worrying about health insurance, are they going to educate their kids, are they going to be able to keep their job? And what are we getting from the media? Well, the record shows that we're getting less and less coverage. A study was done comparing the presidential election in 1996 to the presidential election in 2000 on the evening news, and they discovered that coverage of that presidential race had dropped by a third. And the average presidential candidate's soundbite on the evening news in 2000 was 8 seconds, 8 to 9 seconds for them to get their thoughts across on the great issues of the day. And when you get down to coverage of the congressional races, or the local races, the situation is downright dismal. In the 2002 congressional elections, just 2 years ago, over half of the evening local news broadcasts, over half of them, contain no mention whatsoever of campaign coverage. Some people who have studied this issue have said that many Americans likely see more primetime television in a single night than they see campaign coverage during the entire course of the campaign. And what coverage there is, you know as well as I what it focuses on. It focuses on the latest tracking polls, handicapping the horse race, rather than on the serious issues that the nation needs to be discussing. People today are actually getting most of their election information on television and radio from paid campaign advertisements, which, not so incidentally, translate into huge, huge profits for the broadcast companies. Other trends worry me as well. At least one company, Sinclair Broadcast Group, has decided that it has been given the privilege to use the public airwaves for over 60-plus stations nationwide to blanket the country with a one-sided political ideology and program on the eve of this critically important presidential election. This is the same station group that has a history of shortchanging local communities and local jobs, too, by distance casting news and weather from hundreds of miles away. And an official with this very same company recently stated that it's corporate headquarters, rather than the local general manager, that makes all of the programming decisions for all of its stations across the country. How's that for localism and diversity? I don't believe that's what localism and diversity are all about. What we have here is an abuse of the public trust and a case of media consolidation run entirely amok. Okay, Well, maybe we can get to some of the other points
then
in the course of the conversation. I would just sum up by saying that there's a lot of important domestic issues on our plate today. There's none in my mind that's more important for the future of this country and for the democratic and civic dialogue that we're supposed to have than this issue of media consolidation. That's why 2.3 million Americans contacted this little federal agency on the shores of the Potomac River last year. And I think we have a chance now, maybe the best one we'll have in a generation, because we had all this grassroots interest going over the course of the last year, to really tackle this issue, to use the fact that the rules are back at the commission to write some sane ones that will do justice to media democracy and do justice to the American people. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
CC Commissioner Michael Copps.
Commissioner Copps has turned out to be the most articulate and effective national spokesman against the issue of media consolidation and for more diversity and democracy in America's media.
Congressman Maurice Hinchey.
We live in a fairly free and open society. That is the legacy of the founders of our republic back in the 18th century. Their contributions in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and particularly in the first 10 amendments, were informed by great thinkers of that time. People who came out of the Enlightenment, Locke and Hume and Montesquieu. Their intellectual theories were based upon previous experience, the wars of Europe, the great turmoil that infected that continent for so long. And they sought to establish here, in this new land, a more free and more open society, a democratic republic where people could express themselves freely and openly. And we have survived now for 227, 228 years as a result of that kind of forward-looking ideas which are represented in those documents. The First Amendment is critical among them, the idea of free speech, free and open discussion. But of course, the founders of our republic had no way to anticipate radio or television or the internet, or cable, or satellites. These are all new things that were beyond their ken at that time. It is up to us to deal with these new innovations and to deal with them in a way that maintains the integrity of our society incorporated in those founding documents. That is a great challenge that is presenting itself to us today. And it is a challenge that comes about not so much serendipitously as by design. It is designed by certain people in our country who believe that we should not have so much the free and open exchange of ideas, but they should be in charge of determining what ideas are disseminated in our country and how the discussion of those ideas take place. That's not a new thought or a new theory, but it's expressing itself in our country at this time in a new and challenging and extremely dangerous way, because it is done in the context of radio and television and the other communication tools that we have. It began in earnest in 1987 when the Federal Communications Commission during the Reagan administration began the process of consolidation in the media and began to allow for the elimination of that diversity and to encourage the consolidation, the ownership of more and more radio stations by fewer and fewer people. It was accelerated greatly in 1996, the year after Newt Gingrich took over the majority in the House of Representatives, with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. In the context of that Telecommunications Act, we saw increasingly rapid encouragement of consolidation of radio and television and newspapers. So that today, for example, you have one corporation, Fox, owned by Rupert Murdoch, which broadcasts to 40% of the American television viewing audience. Another corporation named Sinclair that broadcasts to 25% of the American viewing audience. 65% of the American viewing audience essentially watched television stations owned by those two corporations. And they are intent upon getting their point of view across at the expense of other points of view. We have had numerous examples of people who worked for Rupert Murdoch, for example, who leave that corporation, and as they leave, say that they can no longer stand to work for a company that is pushing propaganda rather than news, and that's often the way that they put it. Sinclair has just announced that it is going to run a propaganda document 2 days before this upcoming election, which attacks the Democratic nominee for president of the United States. Again, 2 days before the election, with no opportunity for anyone to come back and give an alternative point of view. The elimination of the Fairness Doctrine, or the Equal Access Clause in 1987, is central to their goals and ambitions. And that was done by the FCC under Ronald Reagan, as I said, not accidentally, but intentionally, by design. Formally, if you were licensed by the FCC, you held a radio license or a television broadcasting license, that license allowed you to broadcast over part of the radio or television spectrum, you had to adhere to certain civic responsibilities, certain responsibilities to the society. You had to show that you were behaving in a way that served the community in which you were broadcasting. And if you had a particular political point of view and you chose to broadcast that particular political point of view, and you did so with any repetition, especially, you had to provide the opportunity for people in the community to which you were broadcasting the opportunity to provide an alternate point of view. That was part of the FCC rules and regulations in the Equal Access Clause, the Fairness Doctrine. That was eliminated in 1987, thereby giving carte blanche to anybody with the money to buy a radio station or a television station or two or a dozen or five dozen or 50 or any number that they wanted to. Carte blanche for them to express their particular point of view and no other point of view. And that's the circumstance that prevails in our country today. You cannot sustain a democratic republic without the free and open exchange of information, and therefore the free and open exchange of ideas. That is all in the process of changing as a result of these changes in the law and the regulations of the FCC. Commissioner Copps talked about the major change that came about as a result within the FCC, as a result of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. That change pushed through on a partisan basis in early June of 2003. And that provided for a rapid acceleration in ownership of radio and television and newspapers, so that a handful of people could control all of the information and therefore all of the ideas that are disseminated over the public airwaves and through newspapers in specific communities around the country. Can you think of anything more perverse in a democratic society? Can you think of anything about which we ought to be more outraged, more in opposition, than a government that encourages that kind of activity and actually, beyond encouraging it, ushers it in, not just makes it possible, but facilitates it? That's what our government has done, the government of the United States, in earnest since 1987. And we should not allow it to happen. The 1934 Federal Communications Act, in many ways, was informed by activities that were taking place, political activities that were taking place in Europe during the 1930s, where fascist governments took over the radio system and broadcast only their message to their people. That was one of the experiences that informed the FCC Act of 1934. In 1945, the Supreme Court declared, and I quote, "The widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources is essential to the welfare of the public." We are not meeting that standard of 1945 today. As a consequence, I've introduced legislation that would begin to reverse the media monopolization of the last 20 years. The bill is H.R. 4069. It's called the Media Ownership Reform Act of 2004. It would reinstate the fairness doctrine, reduce the number of radio and TV stations one company can own, and prohibit one company from owning both a cable system and a TV station in the same local community. It would also strengthen broadcasters' public interest requirements and provide for more independently produced programming on television. This is comprehensive reform, and I believe it is exactly what is needed at this time. The American public is not happy with the status quo. They sense, many of them, and only sense in many cases, that something is definitely wrong with what is happening over the public broadcasting system. And they're becoming more concerned about it. And we saw that concern expressed in the number of phone calls and letters and emails that were communicated to the FCC after that decision of June 2003. Ladies and gentlemen, and most of you in this audience I see are a lot younger than I am. You're going to be living in this society for a long time to come. The quality of this society will determine the quality of your lives. The freedom and openness of this society has determined the quality of my life. It allowed me to get an education. It allowed me to become involved in public life, in politics, to become a member of the state legislature, and now a member of the Congress. I fear that that freedom and openness is something that we are losing. And I fear that many of you will not have the same opportunities that I have had and others of my generation and previous generations have had. We need to change this. We need desperately to change the way in which media is being consolidated in America if we are going to sustain the kind of democratic society that we love and cherish and need for ourselves and for our future. Thanks very much.
Professor Wenmuth Williams, Jr.
I'd like to thank Mr. Hinchy and Copps for coming here this afternoon. I'd like to start my remarks with three observations. Number one, the current status of television and radio station ownership and cross-ownership between local electronic and print media is contrary to the public interest passed by Congress in the Communications Act of 1934. The ability of a few people to own most of what we learn about what's going on in our world has had a chilling effect on the diversity of opinion in our marketplace. One only needs to look at the vagaries of Clear Channel and its issues surrounding the Iraq War and the potential impact of Sinclair Broadcasting and their conservative documentary for substantiation to this view. Number two, the public, in the form of tens of thousands of petitions, Congress and legislative and proposed legislation, and the two Democratic commissioners on the FCC, including Mr. Copps, have worked to change these rules. Number three, sadly, the FCC has a history of incompetence when dealing with quantitative data to justify their decisions. And unfortunately for all of us, this incompetence transcends political party. One only need to look at the primetime access rule passed in 1970 to look at how the FCC basically ignored research conducted for it, looking at the economic impacts of what would happen to our primetime audiences and production facilities. They removed networks from producing programs, removed networks from syndication, and interestingly enough, forced CBS to sell Viacom, and now Viacom owns CBS, figure that out. Remove networks from the first hour of primetime programming, despite the economic study that showed that three other producers would more likely replace the networks in controlling what we call entertainment today. One only need to look at obscenity in the airwaves for other issues relevant to the FCC's inability to handle quantitative data. Obscene speech is not protected, and thankfully so. But indecent speech is, and as adults, we all have the right to consume indecent material. The problem is, how does this get communicated on the broadcast airwaves? The court substantiated and affirmed the FCC's idea of channeling indecent material to times when children cannot consume it. Unfortunately for all of us, the FCC's changing definition of children and changing definition of what time these programs would be acceptable made for confusion and eventual court rebuke. Number three, the ownership rules. And these observations come from the recent court decision of Prometheus Radio Project versus the FCC, adjudicated in June 2004. The FCC overhauled ownership rules, as Commissioner Copps has just told us. The legality of the FCC to make such rules was affirmed in the court. Unfortunately, many of the rules were not substantiated by the quantitative data used to support them. Congress in the Telecommunications Act of 1996 raised audience caps from 25 to 35%. They eliminated local ownership rules. In fact, in the Telecommunications Act of 1996, radio is subjected to a paragraph for rules and regulations. In 1999, the FCC allowed duopolies, that's only two stations, in one market with some limitations based on television station popularity. In 1998, the FCC retained the television cable cross-ownership rules, only to be thrown out in court for insufficient data. The FCC in 2003 established a media ownership working group, which was charged with collecting data and reporting back to the FCC. One study conducted by Roberts, Frenette, and Stearns had the goal to study the availability of ownership of media to represent the 285 Arbitron radio markets. Instead of randomly sampling stations, they picked every 28th one. I suspect there are students in the audience who would know not to do that. The local television rules allowed triopolies, the owner owning of three television stations in selected markets. Newspaper, television, radio cross-ownership rules have also been changed by the FCC prior to the court decision, replacing the rule with what they called cross-media limits, based on a diversity index that it modified from the Federal Trade Commission. The national TV ownership rules were remanded by the court to keep the cap at 35%, but the FCC did not have sufficient evidence to support that. Court decisions. The court used the arbitrary and capricious standard to determine what was allowable and what was not. And the basic conclusion that they made was that all of the rules could be modified by the FCC, that they in fact did have an affirmative obligation and responsibility to do that. The blanket cross-ownership rules were no longer necessary, according to the FCC, based on the assumption that diverse viewpoints were available in local markets from the internet, cable television, and other sources of information. The court rebuked this decision, saying that cable television is not a source of local news, and the internet is not a source of local news either. The application of the diversity index was found to be inconsistent. The diversity index was not open for public debate and scrutiny, a position that the court found unacceptable. So where are we today? Where we are today is most of the rules and regulations that were promulgated by the FCC have been remanded, as Commissioner Copps said, back to the FCC. So what's the solution? My fear is that there aren't data sufficient to justify in the court's mind to have any ownership cap. Now, I'm not advocating that. In fact, I find this very disturbing as a person who consumes mediated messages. The FCC has shown, with the exception of Commissioner Copps and Adelstein, not to be terribly concerned about what we all think about what's going on. The lack of debate around the diversity index and public statements made by Chair Michael Powell would support this contention. The commissioners, after all, are not responsible to you or I. They're responsible to Congress, to the oversight committees, and eventually to the President of the United States. A new president, a new chair, may in fact produce some change. But I think the real opportunity for change must come from Congress. Congress is responsible to you and I, voters, and if we don't like what's going on, we do have some obligation and ability to pressure them. And Mr. Hinchey has given you his position on this issue, and you can make up your own mind on that. Unfortunately, Congress has done a lot of posturing and hasn't taken much action. So these are some issues that you need to consider as potential voters in the 2004 election. Thank you.
Now I'd like to ask a few questions, and since you each have a microphone, if you could just remain seated while you answer the questions, and then I'd like to open the questions up to the floor. Commissioner Copps, I understand that you personally voted against the ownership rules, But those rules are tremendously beneficial to the media. Based on that belief, some people believe that the FCC is simply too close to the very industry that it regulates. What is your response to that concern?
Well, my response has been to get out to meetings like this and urge my colleagues to get out to meetings like this and talk with the American people, and more specifically, to find out what's going on in various media markets around the country. The tendency is to sit back in Washington, have a closed process, look at the pleadings that come in from the various lobbyists and special interests who know exactly what's going on at the FCC, and they know how to hire the lawyers to present all of this to us, and then make a decision on the basis of that. That's what's wrong with so many of the decisions that this commission has made. We are an independent regulatory body, granted. But I think that in a democracy, the obligations of that independent regulatory body go beyond just interpreting the law and writing rules and regulations and doing the adjudication. Congress has devolved considerable responsibilities upon this commission when it comes to media and telecommunications and competition and localism and diversity and all of the rest. And I think when an issue like media ownership comes along, we ought to go to the American people and say, this is up for grabs. This is what's going on. This is what we propose to do. The commission refused to do that. It did it mostly behind closed doors. So I think we do have that responsibility. I have no problem with hearing from industry. I have no problem with meeting with industry. They're one of the stakeholders, but just one. And they don't even own the airwaves. It's the people that own the airwaves. So I'm not going to say that my colleagues shouldn't be meeting with industry. I'm going to say they should be out meeting today with the students at Ithaca College. They should be going around the country and informing themselves about the realities of the various media markets, and then maybe we could come up with a record and the data that would withstand the kind of court scrutiny that we're going to need to withstand to write good rules.
Thank you, Commissioner. Congressman Hinchey, in January, Congress voted that no company could own television stations reaching more than a 39% share of all U.S. households. Both CBS and Fox were already very close to that 39% limit before the vote occurred. Did that fact play any role in choosing 39% as the particular number as opposed to some other number?
Well, it may well have. I didn't choose that 39 number myself, so I don't know, and I wasn't part of the discussion as to why the number was 39, but it may very well have. I think what you're talking about was the amendment to the appropriations bill. That amendment to the appropriations bill was something that I initiated in the appropriations committee earlier. And in the initial legislation, we sought to go much further. But in the process of doing this, myself and one of my colleagues from North Carolina, who were the two people who initiated it in the Appropriations Committee, David Price is his name. We attracted a lot of attention from other members of the committee senior to ourselves, and they sought to take the lead on it. And we let them do it. They then passed this one amendment with the 39 number attached to it. And we were willing to do that, to go along with that process to that extent, because this affects only 1 year. Appropriations bills are good for only 1 year. They determine just what happens during that fiscal year. And we thought that this would be an interesting exercise so that we could just see how in a palpable way, what kind of support we were going to get on the floor. In addition to that bill, which passed 39, I had my own additional amendment, which I forced onto the floor, which was opposed by the leadership in both parties. Nevertheless, I was able to force it onto the floor, and we had a debate on that amendment to the appropriations bill, and it lost narrowly. Narrowly. It would have restricted it, I forget the numbers, but a lot less than 39. So the number 39 was picked arbitrarily. I don't know exactly why that number was picked, but I was happy about the fact that it passed because it enabled us to stop the process there, and it demonstrated to anyone who was watching that there was a lot of support in the Congress for dealing with this issue and for dealing with it in this kind of way.
Yes, CBS had 38.8%, and the cap ended up being 39%. That's why I asked the question. Professor Williams, we didn't hear much in the media about the fact that the FCC was going to be creating new ownership rules. Was this intentional? And if so, what does this say about the free flow of information that we're getting from the media today?
I can't speak to intentionality because I wasn't in the room when these decisions were made. However, there is speculation that the lack of coverage was related to potential options and considerations by the Commission and Congress, and that makes some sense to me, but I'm not going to address motivation because I just don't know.
Okay.
Can I jump in a little bit on that?
Sure.
I would be willing to say, just based on some of the hearings I've had around the country, that there is some intentionality. It's more than passing strange to me that when you go to a city or a town that has a lot of consolidated media, that a hearing like this doesn't get covered. And I've seen that in many, many places. On the contrary, if you go to a city or a town where there's an independent local broadcaster, small newspaper, 300, 400, or 500 people turn out for a meeting like this, it's pretty big news, and it is covered. It's interesting. I remember being in Phoenix one time for a media ownership hearing. Consolidated newspaper, a whole sway there. There was nothing in the newspaper about our coming, but yet 400 or 500 people showed up. So I asked one of the people in the audience, I said, I'm really glad you came. Well, how'd you find out about this? And he said, I heard about it on the BBC. I think there is some intentionality.
I'd like to thank each of the three panels for their honesty and for being willing to answer questions and now open it up to members of the public. If people could ask just one question a piece, that way as many different people as possible will have an opportunity to ask questions. And also, if you could restrict your questions to the issue of media ownership.
I would like to ask a question about localism. Is that a fair game?
Absolutely.
Okay, my name is Bill Houston. I have a localism report from Binghamton. We have 5 television broadcast stations, 14 radio stations, and 1 cable television station. out of the 12 commercial radio stations, 0.7% is locally originated public affairs broadcasting. We have 3 public broadcasting streams, NPR and PBS affiliate stations. It's even worse. It's less than 0.1% locally originated public affairs broadcasting. Time Warner, we have a public access channel, but they do not provide us with the facilities and equipment necessary to use the channel capacity, so it's kind of like a catch-22. We have 5 television broadcast stations. PBS, our PBS affiliate, does 0 locally produced public affairs broadcasting, none. Out of the 4 remaining commercial stations, they do 0 except for the news. And the news, we all know what that's like. It's really about 10 minutes of news per day. And each news segment is about, you know, tops 60 seconds, maybe 120 seconds long. You can't cover anything in depth. What can we do to make our local broadcasters, either from a regulatory perspective or from a legislative perspective or from community activists, what can we do to make our local broadcasters more responsive to localism?
Number one, you can get involved in this media ownership debate. It's a grassroots movement. Any success that we had last year in getting this to national attention had nothing to do with the big media covering it because they refused to. It was because of grassroots movement that couldn't be ignored. So get involved in that debate. The second thing you can do is get involved in the license renewals of your stations here. Every station, radio, and television in the United States of America is going to have to be renewed over the next couple of years, including New York State. We used to have a real, honest-to-God license renewal process at the Federal Communications Commission years ago. Every 3 years, a broadcaster had to come in demonstrate that he or she was serving the public interest, and go down an explicit checklist of public interest obligations that they had undertaken to look at, and we would look at that and see indeed if that was the case. That's all gone. Now we have every 8 years that we look at license renewals, not every 3 years. We don't have any of those explicit public interest obligations because they went away starting, as Congressman said, back in the Reagan administration when we had a chairman of the FCC who said, a television is nothing but a toaster with pictures and you ought to treat it as such, and the results that you can predict flowed out of that. And we have basically a situation where stations send in a postcard and they get it renewed, get that license renewed, unless there's some character charge against the person who holds the license. We don't even look at the public file that we require stations to keep unless there is a specific charge. What can you do now? Well, you can be involved in this process in a couple of different ways. Number one, there can be a formal petition to deny. Now, I don't recommend that for anybody but the stout of heart and people who have a lot of patience and also a good bit of money, because it's not easy to do and the law doesn't make it easy to do to carry that through. But you can also file an informal objection to a station's license renewal as far, and we're duty-bound to look at that. And on top of that, you can just talk generally, send emails or letters in. And I think we have over in that back table a little handout about how you can be a part of the license renewal process. That's the second way. Number third, I don't want to go into the details, but I'll just mention we're trying to tee up right now a proceeding on what are the public interest obligations of digital TV broadcasters and try and bring all these questions back to the fore. How can we get better localism, better community news coverage, better sports coverage, better entertainment, better political dialogue? And we could use some help in getting that along, too. And it's just influencing and talking to everybody. It's a grassroots thing. Talk to your friends, family, neighbors, decision makers, and letters to the editor, and the whole nine yards.
This is, very briefly. I think it's a great question, and I think the commissioner answered it very, very well. This is something that we all have to be involved in. There are obvious things that were mentioned by all three of us here this evening relating to the law that need to be changed. The Telecommunications Act of 96 was way, way over the top. I was one of 16 members of the House of Representatives to vote against it. Everyone else who was there that day voted for it. It was amazing to me that it got that much support, but it did. That needs to be changed, and we're in the process now of trying to develop support within the Congress to make those changes in the law. If we're going to be successful at any time in the near future, we're going to need a lot of basic grassroots public support. People are going to have to get upset about this and actively engaged in it. And I would just encourage everyone to do that. Become engaged in these issues. Understand what the licensing arrangements are in your community, who holds the licenses, when are they up for renewal. Examine what kind of service you're being given by those entities, and become engaged. I think it might be even a little bit easier with regard to the public television station that you mentioned. And although I think that is a good station, I support it myself. Nevertheless, they are very poor in terms of public kinds of government issues and the broadcasting of those issues. They do a very poor job in that regard. Now, that's easy to influence. You know, just tell them. Tell them, if you want a contribution from me, you better do a better job. And here's what I think would be a better job.
You can also check on moveon.org. It's one word.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Michael Cobbs, I'm so happy that you're here. I've seen you many times on the news, and recently I think the movie documentary Orwell, Rose in His Grave, I believe you were in that. And you spoke very well, and I was very impressed. I would like for you, as well as Hinchy as well, to talk about the role Colin Powell's son, who heads the FCC. Am I correct? I hope I didn't get that wrong.
That's right.
And I'm amazed at how few people know that that's the case. And when I found that out, I thought, oh, my God, you know, how could someone like that be head of the FCC? I mean, here you have his father who went in front of the United Nations and gave misinformation. We have administration that only wants the corporate media to become larger. So I'm very scared, and my biggest concern right now is what are we going to do in the next 2 weeks, and I hope everybody in this room votes. We have to start with that, because the question that I'm going to ask you now is, what can you talk a little bit and how Mr. Powell is, you know, what is he doing with the FCC? What's his behavior? How is he motivating rules to go forward? And with that question, also, God, I lost the track of thought.
Well, why don't you answer those questions? Yeah, just
and the other thing is like what here it is. The second question is, tell me how you feel. You know, if we have a Bush administration, how do you see that versus? I know how it's going to be, but I would like you to share that with the audience here, who's much younger than we are. What the consequences will be if Bush gets in versus Kerry. Thank you very much.
Well, I would just confine my comments to Chairman Powell, who is a colleague at the Commission, to saying that we have a fundamentally different view of the world that exists in both media and in telecommunications generally. He is a bright and engaging and an articulate human being, a very likable person on the personal level. Much of what we do at the Commission is not done on a partisan basis, but is done with something approaching unanimity on many of the issues that come before us, and sometimes with their differences they break down more on technical questions and interpretations of the law than on politics. But just the worldview is so different, because I think his mindset, and of course he's better, you know, he should speak for himself, but my interpretation of what motivates him is this view that the unfettered workings of the marketplace, or maybe go back to the invisible hand of Adam Smith, is somehow going to serve the public interest and then somehow going to discipline media and somehow produce the kind of media that this country needs to have. And I just don't buy that. I think it just doesn't recognize the reality of forces and the correlation of forces in this economy of ours and what is increasingly motivating media, particularly big media. There are a lot of good broadcasters, local independent broadcasters in the country who still serve the public interest or try to, but less and less are they captains of their own fate, and more are they captives of the unforgiving expectations of Wall Street and the Madison Avenue gurus. But I think he really believes that, you know, just letting the marketplace operate and some consume others is good. I think what you see across the whole gamut, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but a whole gamut of issues that we regulate at the FCC is kind of a tectonic shift, I think, in favor of deregulation at all costs, even before you have competition. I think the law, at least one good thing about the law in 1996 was it at least came down and said, deregulate is fine, but first have competition. It's like this current commission loses that last part. We should have competition in the telephone world, where a lot of the competitors have been driven out of business and more are about to be driven out of business because of kind of the dedication of this particular commission to the huge incumbent telephone companies. Watch out for that internet that we all know and love and rely on for openness and being the technology of the future, because if you turn the transmission of that internet over to one or two or three companies or big incumbents, you're going to lose control of the gateway. So I think fundamentally we're talking about a different mindset, and that we can close access rather than open access. We can have less competition rather than more, and somehow that's going to get us to the happy nirvana of our communications future. I don't think that view has a chance. And as for specific differences of administrations, we'd have to see when a new administration came to power, but I would certainly hope to see one that was much more open when it came to these questions of open access, open technologies, really encouraging entrepreneurship and innovation, and doing something about this onerous drift towards media consolidation that is imperiling our democracy.
Thank you.
You're listening to a forum on media consolidation held October 19th at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, Free Radio Olympia, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KFAR Knoxville, or KRFP Moscow, Idaho, 92.5. We continue.
Commissioner Copps, the reason I even know about you is because of a radio station here, which is actually broadcast out of Geneva, New York, which is the next lake over and belongs to Hobart and William Smith College. This is a success story, I might add. I want to just say something about that, because when people talk about the lack of media, I think they should look to the radio. We're fortunate in Ithaca to be able to receive this station, and the reason that most of Ithaca can receive this station at all is because of two women who put a repeater station on top of some barn over there on East Hill and is picking up the station at 89.7, and they're rebroadcasting it on 88.1. I mean, these people, this woman took a $10,000 loan out on her house so that they could establish the station. So it's really much to be said. My question, however, is to Congressman Hinchy. When I was growing up, and I remember a civics teacher saying that one of the first things you did when you took over a country by force was you took over the communications. And when I was growing up, there used to be something called an anti-monopoly law. Whatever happened to that? I mean, it's almost like, I mean, they used to talk about antitrust and vertical and horizontal monopolies, and you don't even hear of, I haven't heard of that in years and years and years, and whatever happened to that?
Well, the enforcement of the antitrust laws are in the hands of John Ashcroft. I don't think any more needs to be said about that. Yes, the kind of consolidation that you're seeing in the media is definitely antitrust, but it is being written into the law so that, in effect, it contradicts any language in the antitrust laws that might have affected it in some way. Telecommunications Act of 96, the laws in the 80s just in effect authorized this kind of consolidation. They usher it in, and those laws need to be changed. It's arguable that you could approach this from an antitrust point of view, and if you had a attorney general who was the reincarnation of Teddy Roosevelt, perhaps, you know, you might see some enforcement of antitrust. But we haven't had the enforcement of antitrust laws in this country in decades. And it's because of the increasing power of corporate America. Corporations are increasingly taking over this country. And as a result, the democratic process is suffering. And the individual rights of citizens is suffering. That needs to be reversed. It goes on in Washington every single day in the form of the massive amount of money that's spent by lobbyists and on lobbying. And that's the situation that we confront. I think that, you know, maybe the people of our country are beginning to wake up, and maybe it's this particular issue that is causing them to become more alert and concerned about the way in which rights and opportunities are being circumscribed by the corporate entities in our country.
Commissioner Copps, you referred to various laws mentioning public interest over and over and over again, but it seems like throughout the whole history of broadcasting in this country, broadcasting has been treated as a business and as a profit opportunity. And when spectrum was allocated in radio, almost all of it went to money-making operations. How do you expect to have real public service when most of the broadcasters are in there for a profit? They're interested in money. They're people with money. And it seems that their interests are not necessarily the same as those of the communities they are supposed to serve. What can be done about the whole model of the way broadcasting is considered to bring it to a service instead of a business?
Well, I think as a regulator, I have to deal with the construct that we have, and I think the decision was made in this country a long time ago that broadcasting would be part of our business system and our capitalist system rather than than a publicly owned and operated enterprise. So if that was to change, that would be